Thank you, Your Honor. Virginia Mason does not dispute that its plan violates the Medicare Secondary Payer Act's prohibition on taking into account that an individual is eligible for Medicare benefits. Unlike Amy's Kitchen, they made the mistake of saying the quiet part out loud, explicitly saying in the plan that reimbursement for dialysis will be drastically reduced, in the words of the plan, quote, once the member is eligible to become qualified for Medicare coverage for ESRD, unquote. That's excerpt of record page 84. Virginia Mason argues that it is facially unlawful plan provision is not actionable because the MSP private right of action is unavailable unless Medicare steps in and pays instead. I have 3 points in response. First, both the statute's text and its regulatory history make clear that DaVita has a cause of action regardless of whether Medicare pays. The plan's interpretation would make the statute virtually a dead letter that couldn't be used, except when the government mistakenly made a payment. Secondly, even if the statute did require Medicare to pay, that's exactly what happened here. Medicare paid because Virginia Mason forced patient one off its plan 20 months into the coordination period. Finally, third, it is overwhelmingly clear that Virginia Mason violated the MSP when it changed its terms to reduce benefits for Medicare eligible patients alone. Virginia Mason doesn't dispute that, nor could it. Although the district court did not address this issue, this court should reach the issue on appeal and resolve in DaVita's favor. So to begin, the MSP Act's broad cause of action says literally nothing about anyone else needing to pay before a cause of action arises, and nothing about Medicare, period. Instead, it only speaks about what the plan must do to trigger the cause of action, namely, fail to provide for primary payment or appropriate reimbursement. I'll get to the cross-reference in just a second. It would be very unusual to prevent a party from suing for injury to itself until a third party suffers injury, and the plan identifies no other statute that works that way. Now, the plan says that Congress smuggled that requirement of payment into the statute through an oblique cross-reference. The statute speaks of the primary plan failing to provide primary payment, in accordance with paragraphs 1 and 2A. But the text and the regulatory history just won't support that reading. First, the plan gives no explanation why Congress would impose such a basic limitation, basically adding an entirely new element to the cause of action through a passing cross-reference rather than explicitly requiring that Medicare have made payment. The saying goes, Congress doesn't hide elephants in mouse holes. If Congress wanted to make a cause of action conditional on Medicare making payment, it knew how to do that. After all, just 2 years earlier, in a neighboring provision that gave the government a cause of action, it limited it to recovering payment made by the United States. And the fact that Congress used different language suggests it had different meanings in those two places. They never explain why Congress was so explicit in one and so indirect in the other. Second, the cross-references undercut the plan's meaning and make clear that the plan's preferred reading would make the statute essentially a dead letter. First, paragraph one, the cross-reference to paragraph one sets forth the anti-differentiation and take into account provisions. I think the argument is that paragraph two must be a reference to Medicare making payment, but paragraph 2A doesn't permit Medicare to make payments. As the plan itself concedes on page 27 of its brief, paragraph 2A prohibits Medicare from making payment when the plan is supposed to pay. It's not until paragraph 2B, which isn't part of the cross-reference, that the statute authorizes Medicare to make conditional payments under limited circumstances that aren't present here. Thus, according to the plan, Congress improbably created a private right of action, but conditioned it on Medicare making payment, and then it prohibited Medicare from making payment. The plan's interpretation means that Congress passed a law that literally does nothing, except perhaps when Medicare mistakenly makes payments. And under those circumstances, the government itself would have a cause of action. The statute would essentially be a dead letter. But as the Supreme Court has observed in the case I referenced in the last argument, courts should not give statutes an interpretation that gives them only limited effect. That's the Nijhawan versus Holder case we cited in our brief. Finally, the regulatory history of the agency's implementation of the statute forecloses the plan's argument. And this again refers to the regulation or the page in the Federal Register I referenced in my earlier argument, 54 Federal Register 41718. I encourage you, if you haven't done so already, to print it out and read the center column. During rulemaking to implement 1984 amendments to the MSP provision, commenters said that Medicare should be authorized to make conditional payments when a group health plan that is primary refuses to make payments. And the agency refused, saying that Medicare should not pay when it is reasonable to expect an employer group health plan to pay. And they said it is reasonable to expect the plan to comply with the law. Rather, and this is the part that I read off the Federal Register during the last argument, when the provider, the agency explained that it is the provider's responsibility to pursue complexion from a plan when it doesn't make payment. That is exactly what we're doing here today. Nothing in that entire discussion, 54 Federal Register 41718, says anything about Medicare having to pay before we could ever go into court and pursue our rights. There was no cause for concern, the agency explained at the time that it issued the regulation, because Congress had created a private right of action with a double damages if a responsible third party fails to pay for primary benefits. Again, said nothing at all about Medicare stepping in first. That contemporaneous agency regulation is entitled to great weight.
Counsel, I have one question about another issue in the case, if I may, and that is the question of exhaustion of administrative remedies. There are no ERISA claims in this case, as I understand it, because there was no exhaustion. Would the claim fail for that reason?
No, Your Honor, we are bringing these straight under the Medicare Secondary Payer Act. There's no exhaustion requirement under that act. There's no language in the MSP requiring exhaustion. And I think that it is, it's just not serious that, you know, after they adopt a plan just so they can give us this lower rate, that we have to ask them pretty please before we can pursue the action. Again, there's nothing in the statute, there's nothing in the regulatory history to suggest that there's any sort of exhaustion of remedies angle. Secondly, as I said, even if there were some requirement that we that Medicare have to make payment, Medicare did make payment here. After 20 months, and this is the danger both here and in Amy's Kitchen, when you give lower benefits and you subject people to balance billing, which is a legal injury under Springer versus Cleveland Clinic, just being on the hook for that is a legal injury. When you subject people to balance billing, people don't want to be on the hook for payment. And it puts pressure on them to go on to Medicare so they can avoid that. And that's exactly what happened here. After 20 months, they said, phooey on this, they're going on to Medicare. And that is a real harm. Because Medicare, not only your family can't follow you on to Medicare, Medicare also doesn't cover a lot of other things that are comorbidities for end-stage renal disease, like vision problems. It doesn't cover eye classes. It doesn't cover certain types of vision care. And that is a real hardship to these patients. In addition, Medicare, it may have low rates. That is, they may have imposed low rates on dialysis providers and others, but there's a 20% copay, and 20% of essentially $300 per treatment is a real hardship on patients, many of whom are vulnerable, many are minorities, many are poor, and to require them to pay 20% time and time again is a real hardship on them. And indeed, they may skip treatment simply because it's too much to afford. The other side doesn't really come up with any argument. The court below said that, well, after it switched to Medicare, then Medicare was primary, and so that there was no cause of action. But by statute, the private plan is supposed to be primary payer for the entire 30-month coordination period. And essentially, the lower court's reading would render this a nullity in that the claim would either be too late and that Medicare hadn't paid yet, or too early because Medicare hadn't paid, or too late because Medicare had stepped in. And I think that that's just, you know, not a plausible way of reading the statute. And then finally, we'd urge the court to hold that the plan violated both of the MSP's anti-discrimination prohibitions. We set forth in the opening why they had violated both of them. They did not seek to address it. Instead, they devoted all of their argument to this atextual argument that Medicare has to make payment before we have a cause of action. And so at this point, I'd say they have forfeited the right to argue that. Because it is beyond any doubt how it would be applied in this case, this court can go ahead and address it, even though the district court did not. That's the Golden Gate Hotel case cited in our brief. And if there are no questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You may do that. And we'll hear next from Ms. Drummey.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm here on behalf of Virginia Mason Medical Center, a sponsor for the plan that's a question in this instant case. Virginia Mason, as a sponsor for this plan, is a nonprofit entity and has responsibility under its plan for taking care of a variety of patients, some with very severe kinds of situations, such as cancer patients. And it has a responsibility in its mission and as an ERISA plan to assure that it is able to try to provide all medically necessary services that it may. Its determinations regarding ESRD patients come in view of enormous efforts across the country to try to deal with very, very high costs from dialysis providers such as DaVita. And DaVita claims that its mission, and we don't dispute, is to provide good services to dialysis patients, but it also is a for-profit entity and has created a very profitable business for it. The plan that is in question here has provisions regarding ESRD patients, and it does talk about situations where Medicare eligibility or Medicare entitlement is involved. We disagree with Mr. Elwood's characterization that we have waived any argument that those provisions violate the taking into account or the differentiation provisions.
Counsel, the way the case is teed up for us, would we even reach that question? In other words, if we were to conclude that there is a cause of action, why wouldn't it simply be sent back for further proceedings? I mean, we have, I suppose, the discretion to go further, but we don't have to, do we?
No, we don't, Your Honor, but I think that I wanted to tee up some context for you in this particular matter. But turning to the Medicare statute at issue here,
the reason I'm asking you is that, at least on first read, I am not persuaded that the plan is neutral with respect to Medicare eligibility, but it seems to me that that's not relevant. Whether it's violation or not a violation, that's not relevant to the question of whether an action is available as a theoretical matter.
Very good, Your Honor. The district court below, based on a very well-reasoned decision, examined the case law of various cases involving the Medicare secondary payer private cause of action. The statute in itself has two conditions that must be met in order to bring a private cause of action. One concerns the group health plan requirements that appear in paragraph one that talk about taking into account and differentiation of benefits. It also includes reference to paragraph 2A that talks about Medicare shall not make a payment. The whole intent of the act is to prevent Medicare having to step in and make a payment. And that's been recognized by cases across.
But I don't see, if I can interrupt, but I don't see that that gets you where you, that by itself gets you where you need to get, which is to say your argument is there's no private act cause of action until Medicare has paid. I understand that there are a lot of circuits that go your way, and the statute is, I'll say it this way, complex and written in a way that, this is Mr. Elwood's point in the prior case, this is not the easiest statute in the world to understand, but it seems a little odd that there should be a requirement before a cause of action lies that Medicare should have already paid.
Well, let me point you to, as we mentioned in our briefs, Mr. Elwood has often focused on 1989 rulemakings and other older materials, but DaVita has largely ignored the clarifications that the Medicare program provides in its Medicare Secondary Payer Manual. And if you turn to the Medicare Secondary Payer Manual, you will see the Medicare program's interpretation of what happened with regard to what's a non-conformance with the general with the group health plan requirements. And in section 80, for example, of the manual, it talks about the differentiation and taking into account provisions being violated when they result in a Medicare payment, a mistaken Medicare primary payment. And let me tell you, just for context, how that might happen, because DaVita takes the position that you can't have a Medicare primary payment that's mistaken. I signed up for Medicare Part A and went to a doctor and got a bill where the provider had billed Medicare, even though I was a group health plan member, for a Part B situation, a doctor visit. Medicare caught the error and denied it and sent it back in an explanation of benefits. The provider got that, I got that. So I knew that a mistaken claim had been sent to Medicare. Medicare doesn't catch all those situations. There can absolutely be a situation where Medicare makes a mistaken primary or secondary payment. And in Section 80, government realizes that you need to run the filter of whether or not there's been the alleged discriminatory problem through whether or not Medicare has been called in.
Your interpretation, though, leaves an enormous hole. If Medicare is careful in making payments only where they're due, which they are probably more often than not, and if a plan violates the statute by differentiating and giving less to or more to Medicare patients, then there's no remedy, it sounds like, in your view, and no incentive to pursue the other statutory purpose of creating equal treatment between Medicare patients and other patients. So what would be the recourse, in your view, in that situation?
Well, actually, my point, just to bring that point to closure, was that Medicare does make mistakes often, and that's why Medicare
recognizes that. But they make them often, but probably not most of the time. So my question stands, even if you have to assume that there are times when they don't make mistakes and a plan is discriminatory in violation of the law, what is the effective remedy that's available in your view?
There are a number of remedies that are available to the patient and to DaVita in this case, all of which were not put into place. For example, under the ESRD language of the benefit, the program said that the minimum amount that it would pay would be 125% of the Medicare rate, but said that was the minimum. You have the opportunity, patient or contractor, to come in and ask us for more, because our goal as a plan is to assure that all medically necessary services are available. And if we have to pay more, we will definitely consider that, because that is our end goal. Nothing of that sort was implemented in this case by DaVita or the patient. Rather, what happened is DaVita billed and accepted the contract rate of 125% of Medicare and did no further following up of any appeal, which it claims it has under the assignment, the exercise of the patient's appeal rights, no request for a higher payment, nothing. The private cause of action is viewed as an extraordinary remedy in the context of the Medicare statute, because it does.
Why do you say that? Excuse me. Why do you say that? Congress either does or does not provide a private right of action. When it does, it does, and when it doesn't, it doesn't. I don't understand why it would be called extraordinary when it makes the decision to do it.
Well, extraordinary in the sense that it would require a Medicare payment. It would require Medicare to come in and step in and verify, counter all of the purpose of the Medicare Secondary Payor Act, particularly where patients under ERISA, and this is an ERISA plan, would have a variety of avenues to complain. Page one of the plan identifies to the beneficiary all of the different remedies it has, if it feels there's been discrimination against them in any form, it references to the Office of Civil Rights, it references to the internal plan provisions. There are a lot of remedies that are not exercised. So the private cause of action, we believe, relates to that particular situation where Medicare has to step in as well and foot the bill. We also note that the beneficiary in this case is alleged to have been switched to Medicare because of all the threatened problems hanging over the head of the patient. I found this situation really puzzling. Here we have a situation where DaVita has sat and accepted payments for 20 months under the 125% Medicare rate, and thereby increased the alleged horrible threat of balance billing to $1.7 million. Despite its mentioning in prior briefing that the intent of the private cause of action was to permit immediate action by the provider or the patient to head off this kind of alleged discriminatory behavior before it became a problem and to get the benefits for the patient. Instead, what happened, DaVita accepted the money that was paid and didn't ask for more and let the amount ride to $1.7 million and then claimed, oh, look, the patient must have switched because of the pending balance billing and the like and gone to Medicare. Well, the patient, after a month or two or three, I think would have seen, if that was a true threat to it, that huge amounts were accumulating and would have rationally asked for relief, which it did not do, would rationally have thought about Medicare sooner. And for DaVita to say that the only conclusion that one can reach for why that patient switched to Medicare is because of the plan's activities and these balance billing threats also doesn't make a lot of sense. This is an ESRD patient. They're not well. They're having a lot of time spent in dialysis. They're Medicare, and they are thinking likely of retirement. They're thinking about what will my premiums be? Things like many other kinds of things that could be going on here. So the injury to the patient and the injury to the plan are pretty much self-generated by DaVita sitting on its arms and not trying to use any of the other available methods for getting relief. We also note that the district court decided based on the Medicare payment necessity. It did not reach the standing issue. It felt it did not need to. It did not reach a lot of the other arguments that the plan presented. But we have noted and note again that we think the Article 3 standing requirements are not met here. The type of threatened problem that the $1.7 million of non-billed balance billing presents is not an imminent threat because they never billed it. They never threatened to bill it. And as the amicus briefs have provided, they don't bill it. So it is hard for that to be considered an imminent threat. And we offer to you that we think Article 3 standing is missing in this case. With regard to any other questions that you might have, again, we offer that the Medicare secondary payor provisions in the manual offer a much more up-to-date view of CMS's notion that primary Medicare payments, mistaken ones, are required, that they offer the notion that providers and beneficiaries would be expected to exhaust all collection kinds of activities that were available to them. To the extent it's at all relevant here, the 1989 has been superseded by the 2005 Medicare secondary payor manual provisions. But in any event, the real thing that CMS was telling providers there is you have to go pursue collection proceedings. We want you to take care of the problem without Medicare having to get involved or without there being a danger of Medicare having to be involved. So we offer here, DaVita did not do any of those kind of regular collection activities at all. It didn't bill us again. It didn't file appeals. It didn't do anything of the sort. So we ask that you affirm the district court opinion requiring a Medicare payment in order to bring the private cause of action, and that DaVita lacks Article 3 standing, as does the patient. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Elwood, you have some rebuttal time remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll begin where Ms. Drummy ended, talking about the DaVita's supposed failure to pursue other remedies, including, you know, submitting and asking Pretty Please for additional money. To begin with, that is differentiation. I would say that that's differentiation in any manner. If you say everyone else, we pay the full amount, but for Medicare, you got to bow and scrape, if you're Medicare eligible because of ESRD, you have to come and bow and scrape and do this separate appeal procedure, even though we recognize, as Ms. Drummy said, that you're sick and doing dialysis three times a week. That's, you know, there's no statutory requirement that they have to do that, and I think it's unrealistic to expect that the patient should have to do that. Secondly, with respect to the Medicare manual, I just ask you to look at page 17 of a reply brief, because it simply doesn't support, the sections that she read simply doesn't support it. There are other portions of the plan that say people are in non-compliance or failing to comply with the prohibitions on differentiation and taking into account. And they don't say, those portions don't say anything about Medicare having to pay first. And again, I would point you to, I sound like a broken record, but 54 Federal Register 41718, they discuss the whole issue, and there's nothing in there about Medicare having to pay first. That's authoritative guidance from the agency. They've never walked away from that. Now, Judge Fletcher mentioned the circuit law on point. And I just wanted to point out specifically the Sixth Circuit case, which I think is the most on point, simply isn't on point, and it isn't persuasive. That is the biomedical applications case that was mentioned by Mr. Short during the last argument. First, I want to point out that whatever it stands for, it is based on an error. Let me point you to page 286 of the opinion. It says that, quote, subparagraph 2A instructs that when a primary plan violates that prohibition on differentiation and accordingly fails to pay for treatment, Medicare may make a conditional payment for the treatment. That's, again, 286. So they read 2A exactly backwards. They say 2A permits payment when, as Virginia Mason says at page 27 of their brief, 2A prohibits payment. So to begin with, it's based on a legal error. Secondly, that case involved a different question, whether, quote, for a private insurer to be liable under the private cause of action, the private insurer's responsibility to pay must be demonstrated, e.g. via a prior judgment or settlement prior to the litigation, unquote. That's at page 279. And so they were facing a very different question, and every statement they say is in response to that. They say, no, you don't have to actually have it reduced to judgment. And they say, you're liable if the plan fails to pay and Medicare steps in. Well, sure, that's enough. That's sufficient for liability, but that doesn't say anywhere that it's necessary. And that's what Judge White's concurrence says. She says that, quote, a primary plan fails to pay in accordance with 1 and 2A when it terminates a plan holder's coverage and thereby induces, oh, I'm sorry, that's not it. I'm one down. It simply provides, this is the quote, it simply provides for a private cause of action when a primary plan fails to provide payment due under paragraph 1, leaving Medicare next in line to pay. So I think that that case doesn't actually hold for anything, not that it would be binding on this
court.
Counsel, anyway.
Before you run out of time, could you address the Article 3 standing question?
Sure. To begin with, there are two types of standing. First, we have standing on our own behalf because they didn't pay what they should have paid if they weren't taking Medicare eligibility into account. So they paid us less than they should have. That is, you know, that is the, from the first case that probably was brought in federal court, that is standing. We were injured. They paid us too little. The other side is, I think, fully answered by Springer versus Cleveland Clinic. That case said, you know, if you're on the hook for balance billing, you know, we don't have to collect it. You don't have to actually present a bill. The fact that
we wouldn't have to actually reach that, though, if the first issue gives you standing. Standing exists, and
that's
only
correct.
One.
That's correct.
Okay.
I think we have standing too deep, as covered in our 28J letter that we filed. let me see here. Oh, well, I think that the only other thing I will say is that, again, when the other side argues that that there's a reason why Congress would write a statute to cover for mistaken payments, the government has a cause of action then. Under our reading of the statute, both parties, the government and the private payer, the provider, have a cause of action when they're not paid. Anyway, thank the court for this time, and we ask you to reverse.
Thank you, counsel. The case just argued is submitted, and once again, we appreciate very much the helpful arguments from both counsel.